Is India's digital ID Aadhaar helping the marginalized communities, or is it working against them?
Fingerprint authorization accepted.
I'm Subhashish, and this is Marginalized Aadhaar, a podcast to learn how the Aadhaar project impacts the lives of marginalized communities. In this episode, we will discover the role of digital ID in exclusions, especially during COVID-19, a global pandemic. Between 2017 and 2018, a group of researchers led by Professor Ritika Khera discovered that 42 people across India died of starvation. 25 of these deaths were because of the failure of biometric-based authentication using Aadhaar. Aadhaar is used primarily now for the Public Distribution System, or PDS, a government program to provide food grains and ration to the poor. Out of the 1.31 billion population, 1.25 billion have enrolled for Aadhaar. Aadhaar is extremely dependent on two major factors: access to the internet and use of biometrics like fingerprint for authentication. Both of these are a huge challenge in rural India, and to some extent in urban India as well. At this moment, more than 500 have died of coronavirus in India, whereas nearly 200 have died during the nationwide lockdown. A dataset created and tweeted by Kanika Sharma, Tejash GN, and Aman confirms that a fourth of these 200 deaths were because of hunger, exhaustion, suicides, and denial of medical care. I spoke to Gauri Kyota of Nabarangpur district in the state of Odisha. She and her husband are old and run a 5-member family. Because of an error with a single name in two government-issued documents, they have been denied of any food grain or ration for the last 6 months. What's worse is that they did not receive any rice or money that the others received as relief during the COVID-19 lockdown. That was Parsra, Gauri's neighbor, who was sharing how Gauri's family went several times to correct their documents. They even presented a photocopy of their Aadhaar along with their ration cards.
So, the irony is this. When Aadhaar was first presented and the project was first launched, they very specifically said that it will solve the problem of the undocumented, that it will give the most marginalized, the poorest of the poor and the homeless, an access to welfare services.
That's Raghu, who is a writer and part of the Rethink Aadhaar Collective, a citizen group that researches and advocates for rights that seem endangered because of Aadhaar. And what did Raghu discover about the process of Aadhaar enrollment leading to several exclusions?
One of the things that they've always said is that they've gone back to as far as Rajiv Gandhi for, you know, bolstering their arguments. Rajiv Gandhi apparently once said that only 15 paise of every rupee that the government spends on welfare actually reaches the needy. And the UIDAI was supposedly using Aadhaar to go from 15 paise to possibly 85 paise, if not 1 rupee. But the fact remains that they were refusing to allow people to document themselves. When they originally said that people could come in despite having no documents and be introduced for an Aadhaar, it was something seen as a huge positive, especially for homeless people. In Delhi, I've met people who used to work with homeless communities, and what they had done is that they themselves become registrars. They had signed up with the UIDAI to enroll people into the Aadhaar, and they had themselves become introducers. And initially it went well, but after a point the UIDAI shut down their entire system. Today that system doesn't exist. But the irony is also that today about 98% of people who have an Aadhaar actually had at least two identity documents before they got an Aadhaar. So effectively, Aadhaar has only met 2% of its stated target. And critically, now the homeless have no way of getting an Aadhaar, because as recently as 2018, the Supreme Court was asking, how do the homeless get an Aadhaar? Because you are demanding that they show a proof of permanent address. And the irony is this. The UIDAI lists as many as 33 documents as proof of identity and 35 documents as proof of address. But once you get an Aadhaar, all those 33 and 35 documents become meaningless. It is essentially like funneling the entire process into one single bottleneck, effectively. Because what then happens is that if a person loses his Aadhaar number, as happened in Orissa in the cyclones, he has no recourse. And this is again, you know, a telling commentary on what we forget when we talk about digital interventions. We are used to, in the urban space at least, having several digital devices. Well, I carry a mobile phone on which I edit documents. As a writer who travels a lot, that is de rigueur for me and something I need to do. I also have a laptop. Half my documents are backed up on laptop. Half the documents are also on Google Docs. So if I were to lose my laptop or my phone, I'm not going to lose my livelihood instantly. But the fact is, for a woman living in the coast of Orissa, it just takes one wave from the sea after a cyclone to wipe away her entire life and livelihood. There have been series of people who have lost all their documents. And they have already gone miles to get an Aadhaar number, to get enrolled for an Aadhaar number, to get a copy of it printed. And it doesn't happen always at the same place. They have to go to one place for enrollment, another place for printout. It gets lost, and then they can't remember their Aadhaar number. So they go back to the center and ask them to help, and they say, sorry, if you don't have your Aadhaar number, we can't help you. There is still not a recourse for that problem. As an urban dweller, I could download a copy of the so-called Aadhaar card, and that's something I'll come to in a minute. On my phone, on my laptop, I could back it up to a Google Drive, and sure, I could get a printout of it anytime I like. But for someone living in the remotest parts of India, Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand, Orissa, they have to go miles just to access a computer. And most of them do not have direct access to a computer at all, because they don't have the literacy. They wouldn't know where to go on a computer, and then they're told by this government official, sab kuch online hai. The word online doesn't have a context in their everyday life, as it has become in urban lives and in bureaucratic lives. And that again is deprivation of choice. Why is it not okay for someone to conduct a process offline anymore? Why is it so important that you digitize everything? Why is it that you must only have online processes? And so for me, these are the questions that I find myself asking in my current role, which actually expands from being part of the Rethink Aadhaar campaign to co-chairing what is called the Article 21 Trust, which came about from conversations we had at Rethink Aadhaar on the evolving digitization of governance in India. And it's not merely about the Aadhaar card. For example, during the updation of the National Register of Citizens in Assam, which happened over the past few years, they did collect biometric data. A lot of people were also enrolled for Aadhaar during this time. One of the things that happened, that people who did not previously have an Aadhaar, their data was collected and they were issued an Aadhaar number during the process of updating the NRC. And when they received the Aadhaar, they automatically assumed that their names would be present in the NRC, only to be later told that was not guaranteed. And eventually some of them were let out of the NRC. And then we were told by the Home Ministry that the biometric records of people who did not make it to the NRC would be preserved so that they could not access welfare services in other parts of India. So that they could not re-enroll for an Aadhaar in other parts of India. That if they already had an Aadhaar, those Aadhaar numbers would be cancelled. And that is again the state telling you that you don't have a choice to determine whether or not you have rights. What does it mean to be to not be a citizen of Assam, when technically citizenship is of a country and not of a state? Why is it that someone who is not a citizen of Assam cannot be a but who is technically citizens of India, cannot go and reside in Tamil Nadu or Jharkhand and continue her life there. And so these are exclusion questions that are increasing. And as I started following all those arguments and all those incidences, what came across to me was that there is a very belligerent streak, you know, whether it was the government, whether it was the UIDAI, the Unique Identification Authority of India, which manages the Aadhaar project, in how they responded to criticism of Aadhaar. And I also felt that there were voices all over India speaking out against Aadhaar, but the government consistently continued to deny that fact as well. They kept saying that it is only a few elite voices. In one interview, I think it was Nilekani himself who called this the wine and cheese crowd. And it kind of, you know, was also rather stunning, because we have, in the time since, have had public conversations about Aadhaar. As part of Rethink Aadhaar, some of the things we've done, for example, is going to the UIDAI Center in Pragati Maidan in Delhi, which happens to be one of the places where people can come and get enrolled for an Aadhaar, or come and get details regarding their Aadhaar corrected or updated. And you realize that there is a token system and only 40 tokens are given per day. People queue up from 5 a.m. hoping to be one of those 40 people. And they come from various parts of Delhi. They're actually sent to Pragati Maidan from other centers which say that they cannot, which claim that they cannot solve their problems. And sometimes it's as simple as getting your mobile number updated, or as simple as getting your address updated, and people go through hoops for that. At Pragati Maidan, for example, we met an elderly gentleman. He was, I think, about 65, 70 years old. He lived in this basti, you know, in a slum settlement near Nizamuddin in Delhi. And when he went to the UIDAI carrying some letters he had, and I think he had a gas connection, asking them to update his address, they said he needed an affidavit from the local MLA. And because the Aam Aadmi Party had just come to power in Delhi at the time, and they were really being amenable to people's requests, the local MLA had actually met him and given him a letter. But even despite getting that letter, the UIDAI was refusing to update his address, saying that the affidavit wasn't in the proper format, that the address wasn't clearly mentioned, and it needed to be mentioned, and they asked him to go back to the MLA again.
Getting Aadhaar is one thing. Using it for receiving food grains and ration is another. This is Ratan Naik. He's from the same village where Gori, who you heard before, is from. As a disabled person, Ratan is entitled to food grains and ration. It has been 3 years since Ratan hasn't received a single grain of rice, despite of having an Aadhaar and a ration card. He suspects that his political affiliation is probably the reason his requests to the authority haven't been actioned on. I spoke to Usha Ramanathan, who is a lawyer and an independent researcher, to learn more about Aadhaar's design.
So basically, what this project has done is to say, this is not about a national ID, remember that. This is about every person belonging on a database. And that's why, you know, whether it's the World Bank or the UN system that's working now, unfortunately, I don't know how much they understand of what they are doing. They are looking at spreading this across the world so that all 7 billion will be on a database that they can access. This is not about providing, and how are you going to stop terrorism with this? You put everyone on there saying that each person, you know, it's a very strange project that where they've said people are corrupt. People become terrorists. People commit crime in various forms, shapes and sizes. People need the delivery of services. And therefore, we need everyone on a database so that we can keep tracking them. And people have to keep coming back again and again to report to us to establish that they are not corrupt, they are not terrorists, they are not committing crime, and to convince us that we should be providing them with services to which they are entitled.
So, what's the real purpose that lies in the foundation of Aadhaar?
So, I think, you know, even in what you've asked me is part of how this project has been marketed. And if there is one thing that we've learned about both marketing and advertising, the idea is to sell a product. not to explain what the product is. And that's what we've seen in this project. See, when we say national ID, you know how many assumptions we are making? You know, the one thing that it will do, like we are seeing with the National Register of Citizens, the one thing that we can significantly see it doing is it creates statelessness.
Stateless? Where did we hear that recently? Sometime back for the Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar, and recently for the 1.9 million people in the Indian state of Assam, the NRC, the National Register of Citizens program, declared 1.9 million, mostly Muslims, out of the total 33 million population of the state, as illegal citizens. We will discuss more about NRC in another episode, but how is Aadhaar's design linked to more marginalization?
You know, it's an interesting thing about this project that the project is both about marginalizations and about getting everyone onto a database. So the database is actually about making place for everyone to be on that database. And marginalization is about the people who, when the ID is then used as an ID, the kind of exclusions that can happen. So they are two different ambitions, and I think we must remember that they've never been the same ambition. So there was one ambition to put everyone onto the database, produce unique numbers so that they can be uniquely trained. The other one was about using this as a means of delivering services, if such a thing, I mean, that is the explanation that was offered. And those, when you start using this, not just databasing, but after that start using this, it required many things to work, many things which are not in our control. Either it is because of fingerprints or iris not working, or it is because, you know, from the beginning, you will notice that from 2010, Mr. Nilakani made a very interesting statement then, where he said that roti, kapda or makan is now passe. That is, food, clothing and shelter is now passe. What is of significance now is bank account, Aadhaar and mobile. These three are what became the Jam Trinity, which is the Jandan Yojana, which is the bank account, everyone having a bank account, the UID, which is the Aadhaar number, and the mobile number. So the three numbers were going to be critical in this project. And over time, we realized that this, without all three numbers, or in any case, without two of them, that is, without the mobile number being linked with the UID and the UID number being in the mobile system, this system is virtually incapable of working because of the way it is structured. And only those who are able to make each of this happen, that is, you have a bank account that you know how to operate and have control over and have information about, and you have a UID number which works for you, which means that your biometrics don't fail, you know, which means that nobody is going to take it away in any form from you, including people who refuse to see your number in a ration card, for instance. And if you don't have a mobile phone that is linked up and which you're able to keep over a period of time, you're actually identityless in these systems. You may have an identity of your own. The other thing that we also realized is that, you know, in the UN systems, we have human rights across the world. One of them, as you're often told, is the right to an identity. They have reduced the right to identity to the right to the need to have an identity card or to be on an identity system. So it is not about your identity. When they said right to an identity, an identity is a complex system where, you know, it may be your identity as a, for instance, for me, it would be as a woman, as Tamil speaking, as a person who is, you know, who's doing research, who's doing, you know, whatever, who's moved across, who's migrated across boundaries, who is looking for access, say, into reserve forests and into forest areas because that's where I want to do my research. And that identity becomes important for me to gain access. It's a multiplicity of things. And this is a reduction of that, saying that the UN has asked for this, therefore everyone should have a national ID and should have an ID which has to work for them. This has been one way by which people who can't control either the resources that they have, including a mobile phone, who may not want to have any of these, that is, they don't prioritize this in their lives, for whom bank accounts don't work because banking is a commercial establishment and they are not interested in people who don't have money. And for people for whom biometrics don't work, IDs don't work, all of them become what in their own parlance they call ghosts. So they are converted into ghosts. The real being, this project is actually converting human beings, people who exist, into ghosts.
During our conversation, Usha shared more about the ground reality in the social benefit sector. As recently as April 16th, India's finance minister announced that the coronavirus relief would be given through direct benefit transfer, or DBT, and no other means. DBT is a government program to provide subsidies through electronic transfer to the beneficiaries' bank accounts. It relies on Aadhaar and phone number, both technologies that often fail for multiple reasons for many marginalized groups. We will dive deeper into the technological, legal, and most importantly, social impact of Aadhaar in the coming episodes. But that's it for now for this episode. My gratitude to all my guests, some of whom I interviewed in the last few months. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Subhashish. I'm also the producer of this podcast, and it's part of my fellowship at DOT. There are many people to thank for their contribution, and I have listed them in the description. The next episode is going to be up in about a couple of weeks from now, so don't forget to subscribe in whichever app you use. You can also check out more findings from my research at dotfellows.com.